It's good to see you tonight. Hope your week has been going well. Tonight we're going to be back in the book of John, chapter 7, and we're going to be starting in around verse 28. Sheila, can you turn up, go to LR and turn me up just a little bit on the LR side? See if that's better. Nope. Okay, yeah, there we go. Is that better?
Yeah.
Or is that too loud? Is that okay? Is that okay for you?
It's got an echo.
It's got an echo. Turn down just a little bit. Yeah, just a little bit. Testing. Is that okay? Just a little bit more? Down a little bit more? Okay, let's try that and see. Of course, I can't get animated, so, you know. All right, so John chapter 7, we are going to be in verse 28. Verse 28. So we are in the middle of the Feast of Booths. John, what's the Feast of Booths? There you go, Feast of Tabernacles. So again, one of the three pilgrimage feasts that the Israelite men had to participate in, and it's the one that's in around September, October time frame. And what are the two things that this feast represented? I know it's been a couple of weeks because we were out last week. What two things does this feast represent?
Well, I know it was called the Feast of the Tabernacles, so it had something to do with where they lived.
Well, they were in tents, so it's really the word tent is a better word for it. So if you think about people being in tents, why would they be remembering a time when they were in tents? Right, when they were in the wandering, so it was the deliverance out of Egypt was number one. And what was the second thing? What typically happens in September and October in the northern hemisphere?
Oh, the harvest.
The harvest, right. So it was a good time for them. In other words, it was a big party up in Jerusalem. That's pretty much what it was. So Jesus comes down into the feast in the midst of the feast, which literally means in the middle of the feast. We don't know how he got there. But he appears. He did not go with his brothers. So he comes down and he is teaching in the temple. Now he's probably in the court of women or the court of the Gentiles, which is kind of the outer court of the temple. And that would be a more appropriate place because you can reach a larger audience than being up in the temple where you're just going to be talking to the priest. So he's talking to the people. And as we talked about, he's having a sort of a banter back and forth with them. First, it was with the people in the area, the Jerusalem individuals that really didn't know much about him. And then there was those people that were closer to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and they said, isn't this the guy that they're trying to kill? So a little bit of a dialogue there that went back and forth. And we finished up last week where he says in verse 27, where they said, however, we know where this man is from, but whenever the Christ may come, no one knows where he is from. So what they're saying is, we know your lineage. We know who you are. We know everything about you. We know your mother. We know your father. We know where you were born. We know where you lived. And according to our traditions, the Messiah, whomever he is, we don't know wherever he's going to come from or wherever he is from. And then in verse 28, Jesus cries out in the temple. And this is not just a, hey, let me talk to you. This is a cry out. In other words, he did this so that everyone with an earshot could hear him. He says, you both know me and know where I am from, and I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. I know him because I am from him, and he sent me. So we're going to start there tonight, and we're going to look at what Jesus is saying in this verse. But of course, before we go to our Heavenly Father, why don't we go to our Heavenly Father in prayer so we can get started. Mike, would you mind leading us in prayer tonight? Mike. I'll get my phone just in case somebody has any texts. Of course, you can text me tonight if you have any questions or comments that you'd like to make in the material. Let me get set up here so I have that ready to go. Okay. So he starts out and he says, "You both know me and know where I am from." So he tells them, you know who I am and you know where I'm from. And you also know, because this is pretty much the text here, I have not come of my own self. I've not come to seek my own glory. I've not come because of myself. But he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. Now, the he here is capitalized. They would have understood this, obviously, to be God. But then he tells them that they don't know who God is. Is that true? I don't mean true in the sense, of course it is, because Jesus said it. But what point is he making here? Because he just says, well, you know who I am. You know where I'm from. You know that I was sent by God, but you don't know who he is.
But I think from the standpoint of salvation and their relationship with him,
okay.
They don't know him.
Okay, Mike?
Maybe instead of saying, you do not know who I am, better said, you choose not to know who he is.
Right. And I think that that's the point that's being made, because there, as we've looked at it in Thessalonians, there's two groups of people that are going to find themselves in front of the fiery wrath of judgment. Those who know not God and those who knew God but rejected God. And this is a very good case of that right here. And ultimately, what we're going to see is this is a prophecy that's being fulfilled. Okay, and we're going to look at that tonight. The rejection here is on purpose. This had to take place because it had to fulfill the Old Testament and the writings of the Old Testament. So who's he talking to? Who's the audience he's talking to here? Okay, but specifically who in the Jewish people? Okay, so I would say just contextually, he's talking to the very same group that just said up in verse 27, we know where this man is from, but whenever the Christ may come, no one knows where he is from. So that's the group of people he's addressing, but he's doing it in such a way that he's letting everybody know of his presence. He's letting all the people know, because look at what happens later on. In verse 30, so they were seeking to seize him. The they there would be who? Who's seeking to seize him because of this comment? The authorities, okay. So it would be the temple guard, the temple captains, right? But they would have acted upon authority of the John 17. Yeah, so the high priest, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, they would have been the ones that would have directed that. Sorry, things falling here. And this is, and no man laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. Now, we understand that. We understand that there was a work that needed to be done before Jesus was seized and put on trial. But I want you to look at this, because remember, I said that the audience that he's really addressing is everybody. Even though his comment is to those individuals, he's addressing everybody, because look what happened in verse 31. But many of the crowd believed in him. Well, this is obviously not the same people who he was telling this to. This is the others who just happened to overhear or be present when this is being said. Maybe this is the same people who saw the miracles. Maybe this is the same people who are listening and were astonished at these teachings of this man who had never been into a rabbinical school, and they didn't know where he came from that perspective. But many people believed and were saying, when the Christ comes, he will not perform more signs than those which this man has, will he? So they've obviously seen the signs, because they would not have made this comment. But this is interesting, because if we take this, and then if we go down to let me find it real quick. I'm sort of lost in my scripture here, but let me find it real quick. Well, I can't find it. I know it's here. I wanted to say it was down towards the end of the chapter. I brought my other Bible, just so you guys know. This is my NASB, and I was studying out of my other one, so everything's different. It's in a different page, in a different place. Okay, well, we'll see it later. But the point here that he's making, or that they're making, is that we have this expectation that this Messiah is going to do signs, is going to do things. So where did that come from? Where did that idea come from? Okay, any ideas? It's kind of a, you kind of pass over it if you're not really careful. And they may have talked about it a little bit in the Divided Kingdom class. Yeah.
I think it's
the way the English is, Mike. What they're saying is, you've got these people that believe, and they're saying, surely this man who has done all these things is the Messiah. So are you waiting for somebody who's going to do more than this? It's sort of a question to those that are in authority to say, look at all the great things he's done. This is what we've been waiting for. Are you thinking that there's somebody out there that's going to do more than this, that's going to be greater than what we've seen so far? Because remember, there's two sets of groups here. We've got the group of people that are just kind of milling about, and then you've got the ones that are adamant that they want to get rid of him because they don't like what he's saying. So the question that they're bringing up is this group over here, not the ones that don't believe and want to seize him. It's two totally different groups of people. Okay, so talking about signs. So the reason I believe that they're looking for a sign goes all the way back to Isaiah chapter 7. So let's go back to Isaiah chapter 7 real quick. So in Isaiah chapter 7, we have a king by the name of Ahaz. And Isaiah has been having a conversation with Ahaz. If we start in verse 10, we're going to see something really unique here. So if I could have somebody read verses 10 through 16 for me. Isaiah chapter 7, verses 10 through 16.
Moreover, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord. From the Lord your God, ask it either in depth or in height, or in the height above. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Then he said, hear now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men? But will you weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread will be forsaken. For both her kings the Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you, and your people, and your father's house, days that have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah.
Okay, thank you. Karen.
Isaiah 35:5-6.
Okay, you want to read that one?
Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped.
Okay. So, if you're a Jew and you're reading this text from old, you're looking for a sign. Well, what sign are they looking for? The very sign that's standing right in front of them. See, the funny thing about this is that they're looking for miracles. That's to them a sign from heaven. They missed the point that the sign from heaven was standing right in front of them. He didn't have to do anything other than just be present, and that was a sign. Because the Son of God was standing in front of them. John. Well, it's a play on something that we read later in Luke when it says Jesus grew in favor and stature, favor and wisdom, I think is the phrase, with both God and man. This idea that Jesus came into the world and he had all this knowledge is, I think, a false narrative. Jesus learned who he was and he learned the scriptures because his parents taught him, the family taught him. He grew to know the things that he needed to know. And he chose, according to this, he chose good over evil, which means he made the decision. He made the choice to do that which was good. So I think sometimes we kind of get into this feeling that, well, he's the Son of God. He was the Son of God the day he was born. He was the Son of God the day he died. Well, that's true. That didn't change. But the question upon us is, did humanity really become humanity to him? And if humanity is really something he had to go through, then he would not have had perfect knowledge the day he was born. That would not have been imparted to him. So he learned the things he needed to learn because of his parents, because of the teachings, because of the writings. And he was perfect in that because he understood those things that he was learning. And that's where we see the imparting in the temple, and we see that he didn't have to go to a rabbinical school because he understood the things that he was writing. Different study, different types of things, but I think that that's what it's referring to. John is talking about this idea. He was a man. He was somebody who went through life. So the interesting thing about this is Ahaz says, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. So he looked at this idea of asking for a sign as being a test, that he's testing the Lord. And he wasn't going to do that. But what ends up happening here is that what they're asking for is this sign of the Messiah. They keep looking for the sign. This is no different than, you probably heard the story, okay, you've got a guy who's sitting on a roof in a place like New Orleans in the middle of a flood. And a rowboat comes by and says, hey, do you need help? He goes, no, I'm good. Just waiting for God to send somebody to save me. Then a helicopter comes by and says, hey, you good? And he goes, no, I'm good. Just waiting for God to do something to save me. Well, then he ends up drowning in the house because the floodwaters comes up and consumes him. They were blind, as Karen pointed out. They were blind to what was standing right there. And so if they had understood the scriptures better, especially the book of Isaiah, which we're going to see in some depth tonight, they would have understood that this is the person that's being talked about in Isaiah. Yeah.
But they were truly looking for the royal trappings.
Yes.
Looking for what Christ brought and who he was and how he represented the Father. They were looking for grandeur and glory.
Right. They got caught up in this idea that there would be a king. And in the Zechariah class, for those of you who have been in Zechariah class, we've talked about this, that the Jews even today still believe in, I hate to say this, guys, but they believe in two messiahs. They believe in two messiahs doing two different works. But one of the reasons that the third temple time has not occurred in Israel is because it's not for them to make that temple known. It's for the Messiah to make the temple known. So they're taking scriptures that talk about the gloriousness of the Messiah, the King, and that he's going to restore Jerusalem to its former glory and all those things. They're taking it very physical, and they're not understanding the intent that God had with the people and with Christ and the work that he was going to do. So he tells them, verse 32, the Pharisees heard the crowd muttering. So they heard them talking about this. And of course, they want to get rid of him now because obviously things that he's saying, you can't have that. So they choose to get rid of him. And he says, for a little while longer, I am with you. Then I go to him who sent me. We understand that. That's pretty obvious. You will seek me and will not find me. And where I am, you cannot come. So who wants to describe and help us understand what that means? Where you will seek me and will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come. Okay. So what was Jesus' major ministry the whole time he was on earth? Kingdom is coming. Kingdom is coming. So he's telling them, this is where, now this is an interesting phrase because it's the same phrase we see back when God is talking to Moses and says, who shall I say you are? And he goes, tell them that I am that I am. Jesus uses that same phraseology here. He doesn't say, I'm going to be in that kingdom that's coming that they keep telling you about. He says, I am in that kingdom. And you can't come because you've rejected me, therefore you're rejecting the kingdom. Now, do you think they understood what he was talking about? No. We're sitting here talking about it. So obviously we understand it today, and of course the writings are for our learning too, right? So we can understand what he was talking about. So then they go into verse 35. The Jews then said to one another, where does this man intend to go that we will not find him? So I think the Jews he's talking about here are the ones that are trying to seize him. Because they're like, we're going to find you. We're going to get you. No matter where you go, we're going to overturn every rock. We're going to look at every room. We're going to look at every window. We're going to find you and find where you're at. Yeah. He's right there. Is he not intending to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks? Is he? Now, this is an interesting phrase. Where did this come up? Jesus has never even mentioned talking to the Greeks. So the dispersion here is the diaspora. This is when the Jews were sort of taken and placed in different areas around the known world. And the way things would take place in the days of the captivity, if I wanted to keep you as a nation from rebuilding yourselves and having that nationalism that would then cause you to rise up against me, I'm going to take half of you, put you in this country over here, and take half of them and put them in your country. People that don't speak your language, don't have your cultures, don't do anything, because then you can't nationalize when that happens. And folks, that's exactly what they're trying to do today. It's the exact same thing that's happening in America today. It's a destabilization process, because when you can't come together as a people, then you can't meld together against the authorities that are over you. And that's exactly what's happening. So this is what the Assyrians would do. This is what the Babylonians would do. They would take group A and put them with group B, and group C would go over to group D, and on and on and on. And so this was called the diaspora. And this diaspora was on purpose. The reason for the diaspora is so that when Acts 2 comes along, and the church is established here on earth, and they are told to go out and to teach, all of those people that were there on the day of Pentecost had to go home at some point in time. Not everybody was living in Jerusalem. So they went to wherever their home was all over the known world. And they would teach Christ and teach the gospel to those people in those communities that they were a part of because of the diaspora. This is something that was planned early on in God's plan, because that's the best way to get things out there, is you spread the word. If everybody's huddled together like they were in the upper room, there's no church that's going to grow past that little place, because no one's talking to anybody except in that little area. But if I can talk to somebody who lives in, you know, Massachusetts, and somebody in Oregon, and somebody in Sudan, and somebody over here, then they can start spreading the word. I don't have to be there, right? I can just talk to somebody that I know is going there, and then they can talk to people when they're there. So he's talking about this diaspora among the Greeks. Now, when he's talking about the Greeks, he's really talking about anybody who wasn't Jewish. So there was a great contingency of Jews in Rome. We know this because of Priscilla and Aquila. They were in Rome. They were Jewish. So there's a lot of Jews that are in these different areas. Now, there are approximately at this time, and according to Jewish, I won't call it tradition, but I think it sort of spells out in the scriptures, there are 70 known nations that are part of the known world at this time. And part of the reason that they believe this is if you look at Numbers chapter 29, and I'm not going to read it, but we're just going to talk about it real quick. It's a detailed representation of this feast. And at the end of this, it talks about the number of bullocks diminished by one each day until the number of 70 had been sacrificed on the seventh day. So they would sacrifice 10 a day. And so the reason for the 70, which the Jews believed early on, was that this was representation of all these nations. And so when Zechariah talks about in chapter 14 about all the nations coming to Jerusalem, he's talking about this idea of it's going to be everybody, not just Jew, but Greek as well, that's a participant in these things. So there, of course, is another reason why they make this comment. Let's look at the city of Galilee, or the area of Galilee. So Jesus is from where?
Nazareth.
He's from Nazareth, but he was born where?
Bethlehem.
Okay. What was Galilee to the Jews? It wasn't the vacation spot, even though it's a really beautiful place. The area of Galilee was considered the area of darkness. It was considered the, I think the phrase that is used is, it's the Gentiles of the nations is sort of what it's called. It's called Genhal Gozim, which means Gentiles of the nations. And so if you were living in Galilee, you were intermixed with a bunch of different cultures. Now, remember, you have two sections of Israel and Judah. The top half is Israel, the bottom half is Judah. Israel gets carried off by Assyria, and when there's a reestablishment of the Jews in that area, it's not just the Jews that are part of that area. They never come back to the glory that they had in the early days. The Judean people did, but the Israelites didn't. So you have Samaria. This is how Samaria is created. And so just above Samaria is the Galilean people. And Nazareth is in Galilee. So this is a play on this idea that he's going to go back to Galilee and he's going to talk to all these Greeks that are in that area as well. And they're questioning in verse 36 that exact same statement. You will seek me and will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come. There's no answer given past that. The Bible is silent as far as dialogue that continued that particular day. Now, we don't know if Jesus chose not to answer them. I'm sure he heard them, but he chose not to answer them for whatever reason. But then we get to verse 37. And it says, now on the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out, if anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture said, from his innermost being will flow rivers of living water. Okay. So there were three things that would occur on a daily basis by the priest. Just before dawn, they would go to the eastern gate of the temple area as the sun was coming up, and they would announce this phrase, and this is, we know this because this is tradition more than anything. Our fathers, when they were in this place, turned their faces towards the east and they worshiped the sun towards the east. But as for us, our eyes had turned toward the Lord. The second rite was performed at night. And this is the festival of lights. This is where they would light up, not the same as Hanukkah, but this is where they would light these huge menorahs that they had. And there would just be this light everywhere. And this is where Jesus declared, I am the light of the world. This is the time he did that. The third ceremony was the water libation. On the first morning of the feast, a procession of priests went down to the pool of Siloam to bring up to the temple a golden container of water sufficient to last throughout the 7 days of the feast. The water was brought up with a tremendous ceremony. It was a big pomp and circumstance. The shofar was blown, the ram's horn was blown, and the pilgrims who had come to Jerusalem for the feast waved their palm fronds as the priests carried the water around the altar. And then they would read Psalms 113 through 118, and I mentioned this the last time we talked. The priests then poured the contents of the water into two silver bowls. One held water and the other one held wine. This was an act of prayer and an expression of a dependence upon God to pour out his blessing of rain upon the earth. Okay, remember, this is a feast of harvest, so they're praying for this. But on the last great day of the feast, this water libation would reach its climax. They would circle the altar 7 times and then pour the water out. And this was called the Hoshana Rabbah, which means Hoshana, which is translated, save us now. Jesus takes this opportunity to make the statement that he is about to make. Now, just like we had with Passover and the unleavened bread, sometimes we get confused and we say Passover and the unleavened bread are the same feast. They're not. The Passover is not a feast that's tied to the unleavened bread. They're two different things. This great day is the same thing. If you go back and look, and I'm not going to go there, but if you went back and looked in Leviticus, you would have 7 days of the feast, and then there would be an 8th great day, Rosh Hashanah. And that's when this is being talked about here, is this great day. So think about that, and then let's read what Jesus says. If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Okay, so they just poured this water out, basically reciting, God save us or save us now. Then Jesus takes this opportunity to stand up and say this and says, if you believe in me, as the scriptures have said, from his innermost being will flow rivers of living water. Now, this word innermost is not a word that we can use in English very well. It's not something that we go around saying. Karen, from the innermost part of my body, I love you. You know, we don't say that. You know, it's just one of those words that doesn't come out. What it means is quality and quantity packaged into one little package. Uttermost, innermost, you're talking about something that's a degree of everything vertically and everything horizontally. In other words, if you think about it, if you believe in Jesus from the little toes on your feet to the hairs on your head, if you've got any, and you believe from the day you recognize this to the end of your life, that's the innermost and uttermost that you can do. And that's what Jesus is saying here. You can't just believe today and then that's it. Go home. It's like going and watching a movie and saying, okay, well, it was a great movie. And then the next day you're on to something totally different. Jesus is saying, if you love me and you are obedient to me and you can see this in your innermost being, then you are going to be committed to me in everything that you are and every part of your life until you die. Yes?
I would say it's to the depths of your soul.
Depths of your soul, absolutely. You remember we read on Sunday about the going to the bone, to the marrow, the word piercing all the way through. This is that same idea. And then Jesus said, or then 39, John says, but this he spoke of the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were to receive, for the Spirit was not yet given, because Jesus was not yet glorified. Okay. So this is, which Spirit are we talking about? The Holy Spirit. And who received the Spirit? Sort of a trick question. This is everybody who believes, which is not just the apostles, would receive the Spirit. Okay? That's correct. And so the idea here is that you're marked by the Spirit because you are taken out from the world in a spiritual sense and you are marked for God with the Spirit. So you don't have the miraculous powers, right? None of us do. At least I don't think so. Anybody here got anything? Okay. But the idea here is that the Spirit could not come upon those people until he had been glorified. So that's an important point, because was his glory at the cross? Or was the glory at the ascension? Or was the glory on the day of Pentecost?
I'd say all of
it. So I wouldn't argue with anybody who, John, as you said, it's kind of all of them. But technically speaking, from a time standpoint, it's the day of Pentecost. Because that's when the kingdom came to those that were waiting for his return. Kingdom didn't come the day before. Kingdom came that day, and that's the day that the Spirit was given to them. And obviously we see that in the manifestation of the Spirit going on to the people in the upper room. And now some people will say, and this is my opinion, that it only touched those that were apostles. I don't read that in the scriptures, and I don't think that that's right. I believe it touched everybody. Now, I don't believe it touched everybody to give them miraculous gifts, but I believe it touched everybody, because the Bible tells us that those that were in the upper room received. And so we have to assume that, based on that, that the 120 or so that were in the room all received, even though there were some that were marked for duties and responsibilities that took them into a different world of, you know, miracles and gifts and things like that. John, that's my opinion, so I'm just saying that.
And that is the same phraseology he used to the woman at the well, right? When he's talking about the living water.
Yeah.
I mean, a little bit different, but I mean,
basically. Same analogies, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so verse 40. Some of the people, therefore, when they heard these words, were saying, certainly this is the prophet. Now, we're not talking about Marcus Lemonis on... Okay, somebody got that. I don't know. If you haven't seen the show, it's a good show. The prophet. Who is the prophet? And where do they get that from? No, it's the prophet. It's a person. It's a prophet. So where's the prophet? I'm waiting on you, Aaron, because I know you. So what did Moses say to the people?
Oh, when he said, a prophet's going to come like me?
Yeah, that's what they were waiting for. So remember the beginning of John when they were talking? I think it was John 2. And he says... Again, I've got my other Bible here. He says, who do you seek? And they said to him, Rabbi. But they were talking about this idea of who is it? Who is this person? And this is the same thing where we go to the conversation that Jesus has with the apostles. And who do the people say that I am? Some say you're the prophet. Some say you're Elijah. Well, who do you say that I am? And that's where we get Peter's statement. So this idea of the prophet goes all the way back to the book of Genesis, where Moses tells the people that there will be raised up from among them a prophet. And that's where that idea comes from. So these were not people that didn't know the scriptures. They knew their scriptures. And they were looking. They just missed the sign. The sign was right there. Yep, the blind. Okay, so certainly this is the prophet. Then others were saying this is the Christ. So from their perspective, the prophet and the Christ were two totally different people. The Messiah was not the same person as the prophet. Still others were saying, surely this Christ is not going to come from Galilee, is he? Okay, here we go again. Here's that Galilee joke. It's like, you know, I went to Texas A&M, so that's like, here's an Aggie, you know, another Aggie. And so they continue on and says, has not the scripture said that the Christ comes from the descendants of David and from Bethlehem, the village where David was? Well, it does say that. We talked about that in Micah. What was it? John Micah 4, I think is what it was. Where it says, blessed are you, or Bethlehem. I know, I keep saying it's Malachi, but I think it's Micah 4. And so there was a division among the crowds because some of them wanted to lay hands on him, but no one laid hands on him. So again, you've got this problem that's occurred because some are trying to believe and say, well, we think this is who this is. And others are saying, surely this isn't that person. And they can't figure it out. So ultimately, nothing happens. Everybody departs eventually, but nobody lays hands on him. Verse 45, the officers then came to the chief priests and Pharisees and said to them, why did you not bring him? The officers answered, never has a man spoken the way this man speaks. So the officers here are the guard of the temple. This is the Sadducean guard of the temple. Matter of fact, this is going to be the same guard that ends up going out to Gethsemane to arrest Jesus with the orders from the high priest. So the Pharisees then answered in verse 47, you have not also been led astray, have you? Talking to the guard. Or did I miss a verse? No, I did. No one of the rulers of the Pharisees has believed in him, has he? But this crowd which does not know the law is accursed. Okay. So the guard typically was Sadducean because the Sadducees were the ones over the temple. But the Pharisees come and say something to them, or they're standing there in front of the chief priest and the Sanhedrin, basically, and says, you have not also been led astray, have you? Not one of the rulers of the Pharisees that believed in him has he? In other words, asking, any of you guys believe in him? Anybody standing here? Anybody want to raise their hand, say, you know, yeah, he's God? No, they didn't want to believe that. But this crowd, which does not know the law, is accursed. Now, he's just talking about these people that do believe. The Pharisees are now saying, they're just accursed. They just don't know what they're talking about. They're accursed. And then Nicodemus, he who came to him before one of them, said to them, our law does not judge a man unless he first hears from him and knows what he is doing, does it? This is an important point because we talked about this at length in terms of a legal procession with the Jews. If you were going to accuse somebody, they had a right to defend themselves first. They had a right to defend themselves first. Remember, Jesus didn't open his mouth, and yet they accused him. But that wasn't the law. And they said to him, so the Pharisees then said to him, you are not also from Galilee. Search and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee. And then everybody went into his home. All right, so I know we got a couple minutes, but I want to look at Isaiah chapter 9 real quick, and then we're going to end with Isaiah chapter 9. Okay, so they just said, nothing good comes out of Galilee. There's nothing in the Bible that says that anything's going to come out of Galilee. And they're slighting Nicodemus because of this comment that he makes. Aaron, could you read verses 1 and 2 for me, please, of chapter 9 of Isaiah? Can you read it for me?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, Aaron. Eric's not here. 9 verses 1 and 2.
Sorry.
That's okay. Okay. Does somebody else want to read it real quick? Okay, Mike, go ahead. Okay, so they just said in John 7, nothing good comes out of Galilee. Where in the prophets do we see anything that has anything to do with the Messiah coming out of Galilee? Folks, it's right here, verses 1 and 2. Because he says that the Galilee of the Gentiles, remember I just said the Galilee of the nations, the Gentiles, is going to be blessed. And the blessing is that they were walking in darkness and they are going to see the light. In other words, the light is going to come to them and the light is going to be from them. And then if you go on, the beautiful part of this whole chapter is talking about Galilee. And if you go down, look at verse 6. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. This is Galilee he's talking to. So they just said, there's nothing in the scriptures that say anything about this. And yet Isaiah was very clear that this person, this Messiah, was going to have a connection to Galilee of the nations, Galilee of the Gentiles. That's correct, because that would then, right, and that's what I think, because the purity, it's like Aryan blood, right? It's the purity of it. No, you got to come from Judea, not from Galilee. So they weren't going to accept that because the purity of it was missing. Interesting. So Galilee is definitely talked about in the book of Isaiah. Okay, so we're going to start in verse 53 next week, and 53, so John 7, 53 through John 8 and verse 11, most of the text, most of the manuscripts we have out there don't include that text. So I just want to throw that at you. We're going to talk about that next week. All right, thank you for your time. Thank you, everybody who was on live stream tonight.